You are listening to a sermon from Christ Church, a multi-site church in southwest Louisiana. Christ Church is a distinctly biblical, ever-multiplying, economically and ethnically diverse covenantal community calling Acadiana to follow all of Christ in all of life. To hear more from Christ Church, you can subscribe to our podcast in iTunes or visit us on the web at wearechristchurch.com.
Go ahead and turn in your Bibles to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. We are wrapping up this morning our series on suffering, as the other campuses of Christ Church did last week. For us, last week, 1 Peter's still after James, right? Yeah, there it is. Okay. Goodness gracious. Somebody moved it. Last week, Jay gave us a report from his mission trip to, Colombia. To Colombia, introducing us to the missionaries there and the work of the gospel there, and gave testimony to how God opened doors for further gospel work through their time there. And I know that I was very encouraged by that, not just for the work there in Colombia, but for our work here in Doosan, in that I was reminded that the God that they were serving there in Colombia is the same God who is at work here in Doosan. He goes before us here. He opens doors for the gospel here, just like he does there. And he desires to save people here, just as he desires to save people there. And so our job is to pray for and seek opportunities to share the gospel, and then take those opportunities to share the gospel here. And so we don't have to go, like Jay did, although it's good to, Colombia, to share the gospel and to be on mission for Christ, right? Our first and primary mission field is here, right? It's where we are most often. And so we can be on mission. Like, life is a mission trip, really. Like, once you get saved, then you're on a mission trip for the rest of your life to the people around you. And so I've been really challenged by that this week, and really challenged in my own efforts in that regard, and in our church's efforts in that regard. And so, Jay, thank you for sharing that last week and for challenging us in that way. I know you talked about Colombia and the Holy Spirit challenged us about here, but you were the vehicle, and so we appreciate your faithfulness there. The previous week, Joel Murrah came and preached what really amounted to part A of this week's sermon. In that sermon, we looked to Christ, who is our Savior, yes, and he's also our example, and he's particularly our example in suffering for righteousness' sake. That is what he did on the cross, and through his passion, he suffered for righteousness' sake, and he's our example of how we ought to experience and go through our own suffering for righteousness' sake. Right now, in this series, we've talked about several different types of suffering. We talked about those dark providences of God. We talked about, you know, just things that happen in our lives that cause us suffering. But for these two sermons in particular, we're talking about suffering that happens because we're believers. Suffering that happens as a result of the fact that we have a gospel message that a lot of people aren't going to like. Suffering that comes from standing up for Christ, from following him, from doing good, and for speaking out to him and for him. I know that's different for us, especially, that has been a message that we really haven't understood here in America. But listen, we're living in an increasingly hostile time, especially against Christianity, right? For many, many years, the ideals of Christianity, right, and the morals of American culture made what would historically be considered strange bedfellows, right? They weren't all that different from each other, and so they were able to really kind of coexist. But what's happening now is that cultural Christianity is dying, right? And I think that's a good thing. But as the gap grows between American culture and the norms of American culture and the ideals of the Christian faith and what we see in the Bible, right, as that gap grows between the two, so does the animosity, particularly from culture towards the church. While this isn't new to the church worldwide or to the church over the last 2,000 years, it is new to us as Christians in America. And so what we hope to do with these last two sermons is really prepare ourselves for how we should respond and how we shouldn't respond when that animosity turns into persecution or suffering regardless of the intensity of it, even if it's just verbal backlash, right? We need to know how to respond. And so 2 weeks ago, we learned that we're not to be ashamed of the testimony, right? That was part of what Joel taught us. We're not to be ashamed of the testimony of Christ. We can't shrink back from a public witness, even though we know, and even when we know, it can be harmful to our status, our reputation. It may put our job at risk, any of those things. We can't be ashamed of the testimony. And so we keep going, we keep sharing, we keep spreading. And then when suffering comes, when persecution happens, when backlash does come, how do we respond? How do we respond when that does happen? And so what we learned really 2 weeks ago was how not to respond. What we should not do, right? And so we said, don't be shaken. Don't be troubled, as Peter writes. Don't be troubled. Don't be shaken in your hearts by it. Don't be ashamed, right? Don't be ashamed, and don't return evil for evil. And that was the three kind of main points of Joel's sermon. Don't be ashamed. Don't be shaken, right? Don't fear. Don't be ashamed, and don't return evil for evil. All right. So if that's what we don't do, then what do we do? Right? How do we respond? Well, first, we see that we're not to be shaken by our persecutors, right? That was 2 weeks ago. Instead, we're to be shaken by God. All right, here's what I mean by that. Well, let's read it. 1 Peter 3:14-15. 1 Peter 3:14-15 says, "But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them," all right, or those, your persecutors, those making you suffer, "nor be troubled," right, don't be shaken, "but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect." So again, 2 weeks ago, we learned from Peter not to be troubled, not to be shaken. This week, we see here that we are to instead honor Christ as Lord. Right? Don't be shaken by men, don't fear men, but honor Christ as Lord. That's how he writes it here at the end of verse 14 and the beginning of verse 15. "Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy." So he juxtaposes, he sets as opposites to each other, fearing men and honoring Christ. Right? In other words, we can't honor Christ if we fear men. Right? In a moment of suffering and persecution, we can't honor Christ if we are more afraid of our persecutors than we are of him. Jesus himself said as much. Listen to Matthew 10:28. "And do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul." Right? Who can kill the body but not the soul? Men. Right? "Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell." Now, who's that? God, yeah. So don't fear men. They can kill you, but they can't kill your soul. Rather, fear God who can take care of both. That makes sense, right? When you compare the potential harm that a mere human could cause versus the potential harm that God could, right? There's no comparison. Right, I read something this morning. It was a quote that somebody else had shared. You know, Facebook is good for sermon prep, right? Not that I did all my sermon prep this morning, but I just came across it, said that fits. It basically says, and this, it's not even in my notes, so here we go. It basically says, the sun is 93 million miles away. If you stare directly at it, it will burn your eyeballs out. How do you just approach God flippantly who created that thing? Like, how can you just, like, just stroll and skip into his presence? Like, oh, hey, God, what's up, dude? Right? He made the sun. And that's just one of billions. How can you just treat him like he's just there, like a teddy bear? Right? So, listen, don't fear man. Fear God who made the sun, right? And since he is the greater terror than man, right, we're to act toward him in the midst of suffering with great reverence, with great fear. You consider their threats light. You can kill me? Yeah, well, God made the sun. He can burn my eyeballs out from here. Like, I don't care what you can do. I fear God. I fear his power, his might. Now, you may be thinking, why? Like, why? Why would I fear God when I'm suffering for him? Why are you talking about fearing him? You know, like, I'm literally talking about fear, not fear as in respect. And like, be afraid. Be afraid of God. Why? Why would we say that? Like, we're suffering for him. That should be, like, he should be blessing us, because then he say he's going to bless our life. He says it right here. You're blessed when you suffer. Why fear him? I think the answer to that is found in the parable of the sower, which basically says that we're not all going to survive the suffering. And I don't mean survive it like it may kill us. I mean, we may not survive as Christians. And I don't mean you can lose your salvation. I mean, it's going to reveal that you're not really a Christian. Here's what Jesus says when he explains the parable of the sower. He says, as for what was sown on rocky ground, this is the one who hears the word and immediately receives it with great joy, yet has no root in himself, but endures for a while. And when, listen, this is Jesus' words, when tribulation and persecution arises on account of the word, right, literally suffering for righteousness' sake, immediately he falls away. Right, so, in Jesus' mind, right, and therefore should be in ours, there are a group of people who hear the gospel, who rejoice in it, but when they experience hardship and suffering, they totally bail on it. They bail on Christ. They didn't like the temporary suffering, and so they unknowingly jump off the ship into eternal suffering. See, they feared the wrong thing. They feared the persecutors more than they feared God. Y'all know this by way of analogy, but here in South Louisiana, we are notorious for having pop-up thunderstorms, right? Especially in the summer afternoons. A few times in our neighborhood pool, we've been out there, and one of those afternoon thunderstorms pops up, and here comes the thunder, right? You hear that first, always, because you can't hear lightning, right? Gotcha. Right, you hear the thunder before you see the lightning, right? And so you hear it, and inevitably, right, everybody gets scared. Inevitably, someone says, I hate the thunder. But is the thunder the real problem? No, of course not. The real culprit is the lightning, right? That's what can fry you, right? The thunder is just loud and scary. But the real issue is the lightning, right? That's what you really have to be afraid of, right? The same thing is true for those who persecute us and God himself, right? It would be foolish of us to fear the thunder, right? Or the persecutor, right? Who is right next to you and yelling at you and telling you you're a bigot and, you know, saying you ought to be, you know, thrown in jail and your kids should be taken away, right? It's easy to fear that because it's right here in our face, but God, who we can't always see, he seems to be more distant, right? It would be foolish of us to fear the thunder or the persecutor more than we fear God himself. Now, again, like some of us are still, like I know we get it. Yeah, I should, but I'm kind of like troubled by this idea of fearing God or having this terror and dread toward God. But I think that's because so often we think of God more as grandpa than we do righteous judge, right? I know I fight that. Right, we think of him as more of our old white-haired, white-bearded teddy bear, right, who's going to just buy us great Christmas presents. Right? That's how we think of God sometimes, more often than righteous God, righteous judge. But I would just like point us back to the garden, right? When Adam and Eve sinned, they feared God. Right? That's why they went and hide. That's why they went and hid. Right? They feared God. They were afraid. Right? God had said, if you sin, you're gonna die. And I don't think any of us have, maybe we can take a poll. Anybody read Genesis 3 and thought, oh, Adam and Eve, why are you afraid? Don't you have to be afraid of God? Like, have you ever read Genesis 3 and thought that? Like, I haven't. Right? I've never read Genesis 3. Like, why are you running and hiding? God, he's great. Like, they didn't know about the cross. They didn't know about grace or forgiveness. God made all this. He made us. He told us not to eat the fruit. We did. He said we were going to die. Should be afraid. Yeah, we should be. Right? No one who just knows their sin just skips up into the presence of God all happy-go-lucky. At least I hope not. Right? No, we've got to have a proper fear and honest dread for the potential harm that could come to you from an untamed lion of a God who calls himself a consuming fire. Right? There is, like, we rightly talk about the grace and goodness and mercy and forgiveness of God, but he is a consuming fire. I think it's healthy for us to have that perspective of us, and it is particularly healthy for us to have that perspective when we are being faced with, or when we are facing the persecutions and the thunder of people. Having that right fear of God will help you to honor him in the midst of that more than you fear them. All right, so what will that do for us? And what will that right reverence and fear toward the real threat, towards God, not the man, what will that lead to? Well, it'll lead to, from 1 Peter 3:15 and 16, a biblical defense for your hope that is God-fearing and gentle and respect and respectful, and the maintenance of a good conscience throughout the whole thing, right? That's 1 Peter 3:15-16. You see, when you have fear of God and fear of man in the right order, right, you'll be able to stand confidently before man and give an answer for the confidence and the hope that you have. Right? You can't stand confidently before men if you're afraid of them. Right? So when you fear God more than you fear man, you get to stand before them and be confident and give your defense, right? Verse 15 says it like this: always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Right? Now you're probably more familiar with that being quoted as a reason to study apologetics. Right? And that's true, right? Apologetics is just the defense of the faith, right? And that's true, but Peter is more likely talking about here, be ready to be dragged into court. And in his time, the context isn't you know, some guy who's like, why do you not believe in evolution, right? There wasn't any evolution then, right? Darwin hadn't come around yet. And so Peter's like, no, you give yourself a defense. Like, be ready to stand before the judge and give a defense for your faith. Now, we are more likely to face persecution now, right? Even here in America, but hopefully we're a long way from being dragged into an actual court of law, right? More likely is that we will have to defend ourselves before the court of public opinion, right, than the actual courts, and I hope that stays that way for a long time. But regardless of who you're on trial with or where you're on trial or who you're making your defense to, I want you to know it's okay to make a defense. It's okay to make a defense for your faith. We're commanded to always be ready to defend your faith. Now, we can look at the example of Jesus and say, well, we're supposed to be Christ-like, and Christ didn't give a defense, right? That may be an objection we may have. Well, I don't, usually it's because we don't want to make a defense and say, well, Jesus didn't make a defense, so I don't have to either, right? That's not what it means to be Christ-like, right? Jesus didn't because he knew the plan was to go to the cross. Jesus didn't because he knew his wisdom would outweigh theirs, and then he'd be set free, and that would kind of subvert God's plans, right? The prophecy said he was going to be silent. He wasn't going to make a defense. He was going to suffer for righteousness' sake. And there are times, listen, when not defending ourselves may be the best course of action, but it is okay. Right? We see that in another text in Acts 26. We have a biblical example of a defense of the faith. So it's okay to defend yourself. I want us to look at it and see, because it's going to give us some examples of the gentleness and respect that we are to defend ourselves with, right? And so in Acts 26, the Apostle Paul he's working his way up the ladder to Rome, right? As far as his imprisonment goes. And so he's made these appeals as a Roman citizen. So he knows that making the appeal will get him before different judges, and eventually he'll get up to where he can make his appeal in Rome and defend the faith. It's kind of like a subversive gospel sharing technique, right? But so he does it, but the accusations of the Jews have come, right? They're persecuting him. And so he appears before King Agrippa to defend himself. And so in that testimony, he tells of his childhood. He tells about how he was a zealot among the Jews himself. He tells of his conversion, how Christ has come and rescued him. He tells all about that. Then he tells about his subsequent persecution. And then, so basically his defense is, here's who I was, right? Here's what Christ did for me. And now I'm just being obedient to him. I'm just being obedient to him. And so he defends himself. And as he defends himself, the Jews are getting riled up and they're getting aggravated. Like tensions are rising. And then he mentions the resurrection, which in that time, nobody believed. And so Festus shouts out, Paul, you're out of your mind. Right? And so now the courtroom's like, are we trying him for being a criminal or are we trying him for being crazy? Like maybe the insanity defense is in play now, right? That's what they're thinking when he mentions resurrection. And so Festus shouts out, you out of your mind? And so Paul just said, I'm not out of my mind, most excellent Festus. Right? He calls him most excellent when he's just insulted him. He says, but I'm speaking true and rational words. And then in this kind of bold maneuver, he looks over at the king and he says, King Agrippa, he says, do you believe the prophets, king? I know you do, right? And so that's bold, right? Nobody's saying, don't be bold. And he said, I know you believe the prophets. The prophets are testifying to Christ. And so Paul makes his defense passionately and persuasively, but he does it with gentleness and respect. As 1 Peter 3:15 tells us to do. Right? And so when Festus insults him, right, Peter or Paul answers him back, most excellent Festus, right? He gives him honor, respect. When King Agrippa asks him later, it's asked him very sarcastically, he's like, Paul, would you just convert me and have me become a Christian here in these few moments? Right? Just very sarcastic towards Paul. And Paul says, I just hear the compassion in his voice. He says, yes, you and everyone who can hear me. And so he answers these guys who insult him and are sarcastic with him with gentleness and respect. Now, it's important to know that this gentleness isn't the gentleness as defined by the world. Gentleness, as the world defines it, is typically niceness, or don't offend, wear kids' gloves, walk around on eggshells, right? Tiptoe around everybody, don't hurt anybody's feelings, wear kid gloves, right? That's not the gentleness we're called to, right? Remember, we talked about gentleness in Ephesians, if you were here for that study, and we defined gentleness there, or meekness. It's the same word in the Greek here and in Ephesians. We defined it as strength under control. It was a word that described a horse that had been tamed and trained and domesticated. Right, the horse is extremely powerful, and when you use that strength in the right direction, it's amazing the things that can happen. But it's tamed and it's under control, and so we. Basically, what he's saying here is we don't have to tiptoe around other people's feelings, but we can't be out of control and hostile either. So we can defend ourselves firmly and persuasively, but we don't have to. But you know, we can't be hostile, right? Be firm, be bold, don't be hostile. The same is true of respect, Right? This respect isn't the same as worldly respect. Worldly respect is inclusivism. Worldly respect means acceptance or validation. Like, in order to respect you, I have to say, at some level, you're right. That's not true, right? That's not what respect means, right? Especially in the Bible. We see this when we call Islam an evil religion, right? And you say, oh, you mean old Christians. You give respect to Islam, right? But notice how that never happens towards Christianity, right? Nobody's ever bashing Christianity, and, you know, and the guy on the news is like, no, you be respectful towards Christians. That never happens, right? That's hypocrisy. It doesn't go both ways, but such is the world we live in, and that's besides the point. The respect that Peter means here is more the respect between persons as people made in the image of God. So these people, these persecutors, they're not showing you respect, right? Because they're persecuting you. But you ought to show them respect anyway. Basically, he's saying here, have the exact opposite attitude than your persecutors. Right? When they're in your face, when they're yelling at you, when they're accusing you, you remain gentle and calm. When they revile you, when they drag your name through the mud, when they call you a bigot, you don't retaliate or try to bring them down too. You maintain gentleness and respect. You make your defense, sure. And it can be firm and persuasive, passionate. It doesn't mean it has to be ugly, right? And finally, verse 16 says, what should govern our actions and attitudes is that we maintain a good conscience before God. We maintain a good conscience before God. And so when we meet this particular type of suffering, right, the suffering for righteousness' sake, we've got to maintain a good conscience, right? And from everything we've just read and looked at, I think maintaining a good conscience happens as we do the things that Peter just said. And so we're able to maintain a good conscience because we've given our defense. In the face of the suffering, we've spoken up for Christ. We gave our defense. We've spoken up for him. We stood firm. Right? How many times in the moment has somebody said to you something that you knew, and you knew that that's not what the Bible says, but you didn't want to get into an argument. You didn't want to confront them on that. And you let the moment pass, and then later you're like, I should have said something. Yeah, it's happened to me. It happened to me a few weeks ago with a guy who was telling me why he was justifying his divorce, saying it would be better for the kids. And on the inside, I'm like, no. On the outside, I was like, okay, whatever. You know, like I just didn't say anything what was on it. Did I have a good conscience after that? No, it's still bugging me, right? And it was weeks ago. Say something. Speak up. Even if it causes backlash, even if get you in trouble, maybe. So we maintain a good conscience by speaking up for Christ, and we maintain a good conscience by not allowing the persecution to provoke in us sinful attitudes and sinful words. Right, so no matter their response, no matter how fiery the trial, we maintain gentleness and respect. We're firm and passionate, but not ugly. Right? That's how, in the midst of suffering, we honor Christ. You're probably thinking, man, that sounds impossible. And you're right. It is. In and of ourselves, it is impossible. Right? That's why this is a distinctly Christian response to those causing you to suffer. It requires a faith that trusts God with them, with yourself, with the cause of Christ. And ultimately, that's really the second answer to what do we do when we face suffering for righteousness' sake. We're not shaken by men, but we honor Christ. And then two, we don't revile in return, but rather we entrust ourselves and our cause to God. And we entrust them to God, right? And so the power to rightly fear God, to make a gentle and respectable defense, all the while maintaining that good conscience in our words, in our deeds, in our thoughts, all of that comes as you commit all of it to God, right? We restrain that urge to revile back, and we redirect that angst to prayer to God, right? God can handle it. God can handle that. And so we pray and we commit ourselves and our cause to him. Again, consider Christ our example. At the end of 1 Peter 2, if you want to look back at verse 23, he says, when he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. And so, in the face of persecution, Christ entrusted himself to the Father. He trusted God. He said, God, you're in control here. Right? Whatever you want, work it out. Right? He's in the midst of being slapped and hit and punched and mocked and to prophesy, tell us who hit you. Come down from that cross and then we'll believe in you. Right? Rather than give in to that or answer back, he just trusted the Father with the outcome. Why was he able to do that? Why are we then able to do that, the seemingly impossible thing? Verse 23 gives us the answer. It's because God judges justly. Because God judges justly. You see, we don't judge justly. Like we don't wait to have all the facts. We make a judgment quickly without all the info. We jump to conclusions, right? We're not wise so often in our judgments. But when you commit yourself to God, when you entrust him with all of these things, you don't have to fear the persecutor. You don't have to answer back for yourself. You don't have to revile in return. You can trust that God's going to take care of it, right? And that's our temptation, right? When we're spoken bad of, to speak bad of in return. Right, when we're names are dragging through the mud or drug dragging, that's an animal. Right, when our names are dragged through the mud, right, our desire, our temptation is to say, no, man, look, it's your fault. Let me drag you through the mud. Right, that's our temptation. But listen, that's not the way of Christ. Listen to Romans 12:19. He says, beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And so when you face suffering and persecution and backlash for your faith, for your righteousness, when evil's done against you, you don't have to revile back. You don't have to make them pay back. You don't have to do that. You can trust that either, one, God will make them pay, or they'll become Christians, and that sin will have then been paid for by Christ on the cross. And listen, either way, that is way more punishment than you could ever mete out yourself. You don't have to pay people back. You don't have to punish. You let God take care of that. His punishment's going to be far worse than ours anyway. Further, when you do that, you're then freed up to treat them graciously. Like when you're not holding on to that, when you're not figuring out, you know, you're not wrapped up trying to figure out how do I make them pay, you don't have that angst in your soul, I'm just going to trust God with it, then you have more of a peace and you're able to say, well, how can I treat them graciously? How can I give them grace? How can I give them forgiveness? And that's scriptural, right? Right after Paul writes, verse 19, let God take care of the vengeance. Verse 20, he writes this, to the contrary, instead of trying to show them vengeance, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. And so we treat our persecutors graciously in our deeds. Right? We go out of our way to show them that our disposition towards them is goodwill. That we're not trying to punish them. That's not up to us. We show them grace in our hearts, right? Jesus calls us to love our enemies, right? And so not only are our actions gracious towards them, but our hearts, like our souls, are gracious towards them. We have that implanted in us. And then we're gracious to them in our words, right? Paul writes a few verses earlier in Romans 12:14, bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them, right? Jesus tells us to pray for them, right? Wish them well. Pray for them. Pray for those things which would be in their best interest. Pray for those who are persecuting you. Isn't this totally backwards? This is totally backwards from the world, from the way the world says to treat those who are your enemies and who revile you. Don't we teach our kids this from the beginning? Like, as a school teacher, one of the things I hated the most was dealing with kids who would say to me, "My daddy told him to hit him back. If he messes with me, I hit him back." Now, I get, don't be bullied. I get all that. But that just goes to show, like, the wisdom of the world is completely upside down from the wisdom of Christ. And that's a whole conversation we don't have to have right now from the pulpit, I think. But it's just so different. So backwards. Now listen, this doesn't mean we condone their behavior. It doesn't mean we say this is okay for you to do this, right? But all of that can be done while also completely condemning the behavior. We can say this is not right. This is not how you treat me. This is not how you treat others. We can say that. We can still give a defense and a loving rebuke. Right? It also doesn't mean that we're not genuinely concerned about them and their future, right? Jesus prayed for those crucifying him, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do." We can do that. So remember, we hold a good conscience before God. We be respectful. We're gentle according to scriptural standards, and we go on blessing them, and then we just trust Christ with the rest. And listen, you got to have Christ to do this. Right, that you don't have the ability to do this apart from Christ. Even as a Christian, your flesh is going to cry out for vengeance, to set them straight, to revile in return. We're just not going to do that. We're going to fix our eyes on Christ. We're going to consider him. We're going to look to him for strength to endure the suffering in a godly, biblical, Christ-honoring way. We're going to trust the power of the gospel. Right, to save us from our sin, yes, but to give us power over the sin of retaliation and vengeance and hate. You do have that. You have the power in the gospel to resist that root of bitterness and vengeful spirit as it rises up in your heart. And we started off this series in James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, saying, "Count it all joy." Count it all joy. Have a new perspective on your suffering. Don't run from it. Rejoice in it, right? Knowing that it's producing in you a steadfast, immovable, patient, enduring faith. And let that suffering have its full effect on you so that your faith is found strong and sure, and so that when people do revile you and they do persecute you, you're able to not revile back and to look to Jesus in the middle of it. Listen, man, just imagine a church community where this is what we do. Where there is a biblically distinct approach to pain and suffering and persecution. Imagine the impact that we can have for Christ if we're able to truly live out this totally upside down way of facing suffering. Some are going to be repulsed by it. "Just fight us back," they're going to say, right? "Argue back." But listen, others are going to be attracted. You say, "Man, look how different." They'll see something different, something like divine about that, something worth having, right? And isn't that the point? Right? Isn't that the point of all this anyway? Like knowing in our hearts and then helping others to see that Christ is worth having, worth following.
Thanks for listening to this sermon from Christchurch. To hear more, subscribe to our podcast in iTunes or visit our website at wearechristchurch.com.